if you see me die, Spike.
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, host of the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. This is an extra grog pod, a break from the usual format for one show only. You can thank the patrons for this episode, as it's due to their generosity that we hit a stretch goal, where we've promised to do an extra nostalgia podcast every year, where we'll talk about the stuff that we're playing now. For the past 3 years, UK Games Expo in Birmingham has been on our calendar of events, the tentpole to our gaming year. It's grown and grown in a relatively short time that we've been attending, and this time it occupied three massive halls in the National Exhibition Centre. There's shopping, open gaming, tournament gaming, cosplay, shopping, a Viking village, a starship simulator, seminars, and more shopping. But we don't really get much chance to see all of that, as a 10-minute walk away, there's the Hilton Metropole Hotel, which becomes completely and utterly overtaken by role players and the Order of Masonic Ladies. We'll ignore the Masonic Ladies because it's them that drinks all the beer. The role-playing schedule is the largest outside of America, with nearly 500 individual games played from Friday to Sunday, catering for 2,000 players with 100 different games to suit every taste. The chairs are comfortable, the rooms are carpeted, but noise levels can still get quite high in the side rooms. Last year, I was in the same room as the Cthulhu Masters. I was shouting, "Drock!" in the Judge Dredd game I was running, and they were wailing, "Yogg-Soth off! Yogg-Soth off! Yogg-Soth off!" This episode will feature me and my travelling companion Blythe as we prepare, discuss and participate in the event. It's all about our personal experience of the games, because play's the thing, right? Interspersed are segments that I recorded before the event, holed up in my den, putting things together. Now, Games Master preparation takes many forms, and I recorded these bits when I was doing the actual graft, getting the stuff together. I've recently become engrossed by Shay Webster's Role Play Rescue podcast, which features a GM journal every week as he prepares himself for the games. I thought I'd have a go at creating my own GM diary with the pompous title, "A Games Master Prepares." Also featured are the highlights about Games Master preparation from the seminar that I participated in, which was hosted by the Smart Party with Paul Fricker from the Good Friends of Jackson Elias. How to GM at conventions. Also, there's a first, last and everything from Kiha, formerly of the Dissecting Worlds podcast. And if you follow his blog, you'll see the details of his convention preparation and play reports. I'll put a link in the show notes. We try to avoid hitting your FOMO buttons. If we do hit them, then don't worry, this is a one-off. Normal service will be resumed next time. Ramblers, let's get rambling. So I'm with Blythe in the pub, we're just having a quick pint. This time next week, Blythe, we'll be in Birmingham.
Yes, we will.
Or being well.
Well, yeah, that's in theory we'll be in Birmingham, but you are driving and helping and navigating.
Yeah. I'm all right having a drink now. In 7 days' time,
That was worn off, but I think once we did drive the wrong way into Scotland for an hour, didn't we?
We did, yes. Yeah. So we're off to Birmingham next week, and I just wanted to ask you before then, what have you got to do between now and when we're gone? So what are you doing there? What are you running?
I'm running Acton Cthulhu, so it's pretty much done, but I need to print off handouts and things, paraphernalia. you know, the RPG paraphernalia.
Yeah.
So.
So what bling are you taking?
RPG bling.
Yeah.
Well, I've got some special counters that will act as fate points. With elder signs on. Hopefully, they'll make an impression.
Oh, you're a seller.
I know I am. I sometimes think you should just turn up and say, yeah. Right, Theatre of the Mind, here's your character sheet, here's some dice.
Theatre of the Mind.
Just get on with it.
Yeah.
There's a bit of pressure, isn't there, to bring paraphernalia?
Yeah.
You know, so it's the invention of the home laminator. The world's gone mad.
Yeah. As I've said before, I'm sure that the whole thing's just a conspiracy to sell...
to printer ink.
Printer ink, yeah.
Wizards of the Coast have got shares in printer ink, haven't they?
So, just tell us about the Act on Cthulhu that you're running. What scenario is it? What's the title
it's
of it?
It's called Message from Saint-Michel. Saint-Michel. See? Saint Michael's. It's Mark Spencer's.
Mark Spencer's,
which is enough to drain anyone's sanity, isn't it? But I've set it. It's set in occupied France,
right,
in 1940. It's Act on Cthulhu, Second World War, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. And then I realised I can't speak French and I can't pronounce anything in French. I'm worse at pronouncing things in French than I am pronouncing the Cthulhu monsters. But I've lumbered myself with it. It's too late now, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
So hopefully it won't turn into an episode of LOLO, but you never know. Might do.
Good stuff. Now, I want to give you something here. So, because I'm not going to see you now, because I'm off. Off work, and I'm going to see each other. Yeah. So I'll pick you up.
Yeah.
Next 9 o'clock, isn't it?
9 o'clock.
I can't come any sooner.
You cannot come any sooner, no.
Because. It's the rules.
Well, it's the rules because my wife's working a night shift, and when I said you were coming at 8, she said, oh, well, I won't see you.
Forever.
It's the idea.
But... yeah. So, FPO rules.
So you have to, she has to get home from work, and I have to say, goodbye, darling, I'm going to Expo. And she'll say through gritted teeth, have a good time. And then I'll get in the car and say to you, drive, don't look back, drive, go, get out of here. Come on.
So what I'm going to do, I'm going to hand over this Monday night, because we've decided on for our birthday that we're going to swap.
Yes.
£20.
Swap £20.
Yeah.
And then wander around the trade hall, not knowing how to spend it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's £20.
Now, here's your £20.
All right. So let's see what we can get with that.
Yeah. £20 worth of dice, probably.
All right. Well, good luck with your preparations.
Yes. Thank you.
When it comes to prep, it's a double-edged sword. The absolute best games I've run are the ones where I've done minimum preparation and managed to fly by the seat of my pants, listening and responding to the players' interactions and ideas and weaving together magic. But the worst ones I've done are the ones where I've entered into the session with a half-baked idea and landed on my arse. I still have the bruises. When I'm doing home games or regular online games, I usually jot down the important bits on post-it notes to remind me of the key scenes and encounters, or the sensations I want to create at particular points. Most of the preparation is done in my head. I think I've mentioned before, Cool Runnings prep. In the Cool Runnings movie, the Jamaican bobsleigh team sit in the bath the night before, predicting the turns and moves that they anticipate in the bobsleigh competition that's due the next day. Most of my Games Master prep takes the form of this Cool Running, working through the twists and turns in the scenario in my head the night before. But this time, I'm going to leave nothing to chance and make sure that I'm well prepared and have a number of fallbacks just in case the game doesn't take flight. I've also given a commitment to myself not to leave anything for the actual convention itself, because despite the best will, There's never any time to do any prep, any sober prep anyway. And this time, I've made it hard for myself, as I've picked three different games, three different settings, three different approaches, and three different styles of delivery. I'll go into more detail as we go through this podcast, but let me do a quick run through. The first is the 2000 AD comic Strontium Dog that I've built from the ground up using Savage Worlds Explorer Edition. It's a scenario that I've written already, and I've run it twice with two different outcomes. This adventure is over the top with accessories and various blingy bits. Second is Psy World, Fantasy Game Unlimited role-playing game of Psionic World, published in 1984. I'm doing a pre-written scenario that first appeared in the Hammershell Strike supplement, which was published in 1985, but I've freely adapted it. It's very different from how it appears in that supplement. I've made some bits and pieces, but this is largely a Theatre of the Mind production. Finally, last but certainly not least, is Leoness from the Design Mechanism. The game hasn't been published yet, and this is a specially written scenario from Loz Whitaker. So I'm playing it close to the book. It's based on Mithras, which we covered back in episode 20, I think. There's a degree of old school D100 crunch in this one. So it's Saturday, 6 days to go, and at this point, all I can see in front of me are a series of tasks to complete. I'm not the most disciplined of people when it comes to getting organised, so I have to have ways of tracking things. Over the past few months, putting aside work and all the home stuff, I've had quite a few demands on my spare time. The Grog Pod, the Grog Zine, organising virtual Grog Meet, as well as running games and appearing on other podcasts. The only way I've found of keeping control of all this that suits my visual and casual approach to planning is using the Kanban method. So, here on my wall, near the great library of RPGs, is a wall full of post-it notes organised into columns and rows. There's a row for each project, each game that I'm preparing, and a column for all the tasks that I need to do, depending at what stage that they're at. The first stage is the backlog. I've listed here all of the things that I've got to do before Friday. I've put a dot on some that are essential, because some of them are just ideas, additional fluff, that I've stuck on the wall when they've come to me. The next column is waiting for. For example, I've sent a copy of the Elder Isle map to the printer, and I need to pick it up on Tuesday. And the next one is working on, and I'll come to those later on. And the last one is done, which is empty at the moment, but to be honest, I usually end up tearing up the post-it once I've completed it. That's it. A visual guide. Right, let's fire up this printer and pick them off one by one. Right, by some strange miracle, we've got here.
We managed to get here with relative ease.
Yeah.
Driving the right direction for a change.
Yeah, we didn't end up in Chelmsford or something.
Chelmsford? I don't think you'd end up in Chelmsford if you tried.
Yeah, so we sat in the car, in the car park.
Okay.
So before going, I just wanted to check with you, because we're not just running games here, are we? We're playing games. What games have you got
planned? I've got, this afternoon, I've got Barbarians of Lemuria.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm looking forward to. A game I recently acquired, but I've not played it or run it yet. So it seemed like a good idea to have a go at it. I like it. I think it's a nice little game. Sword and sorcery, Conan style stuff. This evening I'm playing a bit of 5th edition D&D, because I run a lot of D&D, as you know, online for our Wednesday night group. But I don't play it very often. I've only played it.
We did Mines of Phandelver, didn't we?
Mines of Phandelver. I played with Steve Ray
at Convergence, but I've not played a lot of it, so I quite like being a player because it's a different experience, isn't it? So
yeah,
that's today. Yes,
a packed program.
Packed program, yeah.
So Barbarians of Lemuria, it's quite a simple system, isn't it? That?
Yeah, it's a simple kind of 2d6 system with bonus dice and negative, like an advantage. Yeah, again, 2d6, get an extra d6 in certain situations, and another d6 that you take the lowest or the highest, that kind of thing. A boon and a bane, I think we call it, don't we?
Oh, right.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a nice game because it's one of those that sort of economics stack up as well, because it's a game with the whole thing in one book. So you get the monsters, you get the setting, you get the characters, you get all that sort of stuff. And there's a real, there's a good feeling when you read the rule books, a sense of proper sword and sorcery, you know.
Yeah.
Sorcerers tend to be the bad guys, you're the heroes, that kind of thing. You know, pirates and rescuing slaves and that kind of thing. Good fun, I think, you know.
Yeah, that's good. Well, this afternoon I've got Legend of the Five Rings, which, again, I have acquired, to use your phraseology.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're using. We're using Expo as kind of experimental
stage,
aren't we, to try games we've got but not run yet.
Yeah. Show us how it's done.
Yeah.
Because that's got a peculiar dice that isn't straightforward.
No.
No. And there's a lot of material published, a lot of setting detail built into the characters. So I'm interested to see how that plays out. Tomorrow morning I've got a game. I have to look at the word because I can't say it.
Okay.
It's Carpanium. Is that how you say it? Carpanium.
Carpanium.
Carpanium. Carpanium.
Sounds like a kind of cough mixture. You might go into the chemist and say, have you got a bottle of Carpanium? Yeah. Right, you're feeling a bit chesty, yeah.
Where do you want me to rub it? The Tales of the Dragon Marked.
Oh, yeah. Right, so, okay.
Now, I don't know a lot about it, clearly. I don't know even to say
it. You can't even say it.
But I believe that it's a bit of a Ray Harryhausen type, ancient Arabian Nights type thing. So I'm interested to find out what that is. Partly because the Games Master said that I can play Caroline Monroe in it. So
did he?
I'm not going to pass over a chance like that.
No, no. You won't leave the tent.
Right. We better leave this car, hadn't we? Let's go and see what's going down.
Okay.
Kehar here, formerly of Dissecting Worlds, sat in Clitheroe, which is a bit odd. My first, my last, my everything. My first was quite boring Redbox D&D, inspired by, God help me, the D&D cartoon. I decided the only person who was going to GM was me, so I knocked up a dungeon involving a black swamp dragon and an evil baron. And ran that for my mate Eduardo. Subsequent gaming experiences with Eduardo proved a unfathomable ability to take any rule set and break it in the interest of power gaming and min-maxing. And unsurprisingly, he's now a merchant banker. That was my first. My last is I'm having a giggle. On Wednesday lunchtimes at Just Play Game in Liverpool, 12 till 2. If you're Liverpool based, you're very welcome to pop along. Playing Marvel Superheroes, and the three regulars have fashioned together the League of Liverpool Legends, which is not a touring bunch of veteran football after dinner speakers, but a superhero team based out of the Triad building in Bootle, and they will fight any supervillainy that has purple bins. They may even stretch to the Wirral and Sefton at a push. But that's proving a lot of fun and is very easily done in the 90-minute sort of extended lunchtime we have to play. It lends itself to kind of a single four-colour comic action type setup. So that's good. And my everything, people might not know, but if they're not on Twitter... But I quite like Flashing Blades. What's Flashing Blades? Flashing Blades is an FGU game written by Mark Pettigrew when he was 15, published when he was 18, in 56 pages. It gives you a superlative set of dueling rules, which use a scissor paper stone mechanic to really get you into the mindset of your character when you're fencing. It borrows from the traveller type career path, but that's actually an element in play because your characters have careers. They could be in the army, they could be bankers, they could be churchmen, they could be a combination, they could be in finance, they could be members of gentlemen clubs, and on an annual type basis you see what happens in their careers. And this is all part of the social rank mechanism, which is one of the ways your characters advance. They don't just get better at hitting things or get an extra hit point now and again. They also rise in social status. It's a great game. There's a lot of good support in terms of scenarios that were published at the time. My lot have the Cauldroneers, so-called, because they live in the house of the Bubbling Cauldron, their lodging house. Have just finished The Ambassador's Tales, which is an espionage jaunt across Europe. And we're getting ready for a second season towards the winter when my Lady Cricketers game comes to an end. But it's just a lovely little system. It's got some OSR kinks. It's, I think, a second edition could do things like give cards for the different manoeuvres you have to remember for fencing. That would make life slightly easier. And I think it would lend itself to intergenerational play. Those are the things I'd do for a second edition. But for quite a cheap pickup and quite a rumpy system, and some of the published scenarios really work well for conventions. I've run the Grand Theatre, I've run the Grand, the Great Marksmanship Tourney now. I've got another couple in the book in mind. But Flashing Blades is just a smashing little system. Really is. Really is. It's as good now as it was when I was 15. And I did go a good 20 years without playing it. But check it out.
Right, first up is Strontium Dog Savage Worlds. I know there's a new adventure edition of the rules, but I did it in the Explorer edition early in the year, and it's too late to change it now. I was inspired to do this adventure by Daily Dwarf. He ran a Judge Dredd Savage Worlds, an American Werebear in Britsit, for last year's Grog Meet. It was inspiring for many reasons. It demonstrated that Savage Worlds is a good fit for Judge Dredd, and it was possible to replicate the humour of the comics. So the final confrontation was an epic homage to both An American Werewolf in London and the children's TV programme Blue Peter, with a dash of King Kong. Tremendous stuff. I started to form an idea about Strontium Dog. Strontium Dog is probably my favourite 2000 AD comic strip, and I'd been rereading the early ones, and it struck me that Pat Mills' broad satire about cruel Creelman and his pogroms against the muties is as relevant now as it was back in the early 80s when it was first written. It may lack subtlety, but all the better for a one-off game. I also noticed that the strip had a mythic quality that I wasn't aware of when I first read them as a kid. I started to form an idea about a parody of the Odyssey of Homer, but with a comment on the current political situation and with contemporary concerns. It grew and grew in my head in ambition and scope. In fact, I probably overthought it. I had enough ideas to last a full campaign. So, the setup is the Search and Destroy Agency headquarters, the Doghouse, has dispatched a team of agents to Qatar with warrants to seek out dangerous criminals. A con hopper transporting criminals to justice has crash-landed, so the task is to hunt them down and find them, and the rewards are great. So the core task of the PCs is to track down the escaped criminals, and I've created some colourful NPCs for them to hunt. Wild Die,
an arsonist who'd burned down a rill. The Bickle brothers conjoined De Niro's. You're looking at me? No, I'm looking at you. No, you're looking at me. And there's Summit 28, the cyborg cannibal from Yorkshire. Summit 28. They'll get their designated criminal by drawing a warrant card at random. And Benny's will be distributed when the warrant is completed. If a warrant's fulfilled, all of the players will get a Benny. The strontium dog making the hit will get an extra one. And if it's your card, you'll get three. So it's dog eat dog. When I've run this before, I think there's a broad agreement at the beginning that everybody will assist each other. But in the end, when it comes to doing the kill, people like to have the glory to themselves. The pre-gens were created rolling on tables provided in the Strontium Dog Supplement for Traveller, written by Lawrence Whittaker, incidentally, who's the author of the Leoness and I on Running 2. I thought Traveller was a bit too on the nose for Strontium Dog. It's more of a science fiction fantasy. But the tables and the equipment list in the supplement are really flavourful and create some really whacked out muties. So for the pre-gens, I've got Harpy Harry, who's covered in feathers, the Grimsby Reaper, the weirdest of the weird bunch, who's got a skeleton head covered in black fur, Bony C, the Face Man without a face, with a beguiling crystal eyes, Glassjaw Vargas, who's the tank with a malformed mandible. There's Brightman Rock, who's the smarts, a massive calcified head. And finally, the crackshot Gurney Knuckles, whose chin is conjoined to his forehead. So when I've rolled the muties, what I've done is looked at the edges and weaknesses that are in Savage Worlds and applied them to suit the mutation that they rolled. So I've scheduled this one for Friday night. It's the first one that I'm running because it'll need all my energy. I can see myself in full cabaret GM style, stood up for most of it doing the voices. I've got Lego minifigures. I've made them from my son's collection, pieced together the muties. Savage Worlds had elements of a tabletop skirmish game and it probably best to visualise it. Right, so over here on my post-it backlog, create an extra pre-gen, but it hasn't got a dot on it, so it'll probably never happen, not at this late stage. More essentially, I need to soup up the bad guys. So when I've run this before, it's been a bit of a breeze for the PCs. Particularly when it came to the final boss confrontation. The ultimate baddie is Leonard Stump, an ex-space estate tycoon and a TV personality who's the president of the province. And they discover that he's lured them there to televise the hunt for his TV programme, You're Fried! Halfway through the adventure, Johnny Alpha himself releases a warrant for Stump's termination. It's pretty relentless in an adventure. At the start of the session, they have to escape from a transporter they're in before it crash lands. And from that moment, it's encounter after encounter until it slowly dawns on them that they're being manipulated. The first time I ran this, due to time pressure, Stump came looking for them. And the focus of the activities was on the crash site where the convicts have jerry-rigged a huge gun. The second time, they hunted Stump down to his processing plant, where TV viewers were being transformed into pig-like food. In both times, he was taken down with a one-shot kill, so it was a bit of an anticlimax. So I'm going to review him. Now, what I've done with this is I've put all of the adventure onto index cards, because I realise we're standing up. I never read A4 sheets of paper, so I've put them all on cards, which I'll have on a stand in front of me and pluck out when I need them.
So, what I'm going to do with him, I've been giving it some thought. See, Savage Worlds has the idea of wild cards and extras. So, extras fall on the first shot. They're like the mooks. But wild cards MPs can take multiple wounds, and they can have an extra wild dice, much like the player characters. And because Stump is a boss, I'm going to give him a couple of chances to re-roll. So I'm going to give him a couple of bennies too. Also, I'm going to increase his defences by giving him infinity-style gauntlets for his tiny, tiny hands, which means he has a chance to deflect back shots. I'd abandoned the idea of turning his finely woven orange hair into a helmet. It was too daft. Although, to be honest, it's not stopped me so far. So I'm with Sarkozo, just after a game of Legend of the Five Rings. So how did it go for you?
I think it went well. I enjoyed it. Great fun. Really good players. I managed to finish it just before the end of the session, which is always good.
Yeah, it was really good. It was really good how you saw the interplay between the different clans and the different characters, and the players really went for it as well, didn't they?
Yeah, it was my attempt to do an introductory L5R game. So I kept it kind of a little bit setting light. So we had only two clans, the Crab and the Crane. And trying to emphasise the differences between the kind of etiquette and social niceties of the crane and the more brusqueness of the crab. Yeah. And put kind of marriage as the backdrop to kind of bring these two clans into conflict.
So about all of your games, why did you pick this one to bring to the con?
I think because it's, I mean, partly for me, it's a new system for an old game. I've played like Legend of the Five Rings for lots of, you know, many years, but this is a relatively recent addition from FFG. So for me, it's to get practice running it. And also I've run L5R at previous expos, and it's not often run, and I always people seem to want to play it. So I like offering it maybe every other year, really.
Yeah. And you provided some Sarka as well.
Yeah.
It went down really well.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I mean, when I try and do it at home, I try and get a bit of you know, some Japanese food or sushi or something, but I thought a bottle of sake and some Amishi was safer for Expo.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
No, thank you, Dirk. Cheers.
The game at Carpenaeum early to get to the seminar. I've just been playing Caroline Munro as a princess doing a Bollywood dance through the middle of a Mirage city, but I'll go into that some other time. I'm off to the seminar.
Good, gents? Everybody good in the room? Can you hear me at the back? Hello at the back. Hello, how's it going? Cool. Okay, so hi everybody. You are very welcome to the What Would the Smart Party Do seminar for idiots with guests. So thank you ever so much for coming. I'm Baz. I'm co-host of the What Would the Smart Party Do podcast. On my immediate left is my good friend Gaz. Hello, Gaz.
Hello.
How's it going?
Very well, thank you.
We don't normally do this in the same room. This is
a bit weird. Can you go stand over there or something?
You're a lot taller than I thought you were.
And wider.
Yeah. On my right, I have, from the good friends of Jackson Elias, without his good friends, Mr. Paul Fricker. Hello,
Paul.
All
on my own. Hello.
How's it going?
Yeah, going well, yeah. Enjoying the con.
So far, so good. This could be the high point, though. And on my far left, we have, from the Grognard Files, from a great community and another podcast, we have Dirk the Dice. Hello, Dirk. How's it going?
Hello there, Baz. It's going really well, thank you. Awesome. Not spent anything yet.
What?
Yeah. I know, well.
The crowd didn't like that.
You know, they
didn't. Can you pretend you've got something?
Well. Looking at this crowd, there might not be much left to buy.
Yes.
I have a feeling it's all gone. Okay. Let me throw out some questions to the panel as well. Let's see what you would do in these situations, just as a start off a 10, really. Is it okay to show up at a convention to GM a game that you don't really, you're not super confident with how it works, and you maybe only got a sketch of an idea for a scenario? What do you do if you find yourself underprepared? Or is that freeing? Is that something that you would be looking forward to doing? How much do you feel you need to have ready before you sit down?
I've sat down with a GM that has done just that, and the game crashed and burned about halfway through.
Mm.
And we thought we were sitting down to a proper con game. When I say a proper con game, something that somebody prepared and was going to run for the full slot. And, you know, that wasn't it. And afterwards, the GM said, well, it was, you know, it was a kind of play test based on this game that isn't actually published yet, that somebody's put out. And, you know, I was kind of just improvising it. Yeah, but you didn't say that on the sign-up sheet. If you say, this is a kind of improvised game, it's something I'm playtesting, I don't really know how it's going to go, so we're going to very much depend on what you guys do at the table. On the sign-up sheet, fine. Full disclosure, I can choose whether to sign up for that or not. But if I'm signing up for a con game, I expect it to be, you know, well prepared, and the GM to know the system and know the scenario. That's my bottom line.
Mm. Okay, Gaz?
I think you need to prepare so that you're comfortable with what you're running. There's a lot of GMs who think they're good at improvising, who I would have a discussion with about whether they think they are good at improvising, including myself sometimes. But yeah, when we talk preparation, a lot of people say, well, I don't like doing pitches and making pretty characters. Like, that's not necessarily what I mean. Mm. You can prep for a scenario by when you're in the shower, driving to work, whatever, and think about what might happen. What are the baddies going to be doing while the players are messing about? What could this scene look like? So your prep might actually just be a series of bullet points about things you think, how it might go, or what you could do to push things along a little bit. So prep doesn't mean getting your slide rule out and drawing things and cutting pictures out or anything like that necessarily. It's just preparing yourself so that when you sit down, you're reasonably comfortable with what's going to happen and you've got enough in the bank to kind of keep things going. And as we've said before, it doesn't have to be the full 4 hours. So if you can provide something good for about two and a half hours and then you're thinking, I'm flagging it, I don't know where this is going, like, just take it to a conclusion, because people won't thank you for trying to push through when if you're floundering yourself. And players will smell your fear. Like, don't.
Dirk, how much preparation do you do for your con slots?
I do far more for con slots than I do for anything else, as anybody will tell you. Normally, I just jot a few things on a post-it note, but for a con slot, as Paul said, it's a performance, isn't it? You're playing with strangers. They may not accommodate your shortcomings in the way that your friends do, so you have to present yourself at the best you can be.
Mm.
And,
yeah,
and that means doing preparation.
And let's be honest, who doesn't like doing a bit of crafting?
Exactly.
And making a bit of gamer bling?
And you may not use all that preparation. You may use about 10% of it. That's fine, but it's there if you need it. And if you've got a great group of players who run with stuff and improvise, we're not talking about, I don't think any of us are talking about, like, having something set in stone and your players are going to do what you want them to do. But
this telegram took me 4 hours. You're going to read it.
I love the smell of a laminator in the morning. That means no one's changing my plans now because they're set in plastic. Okay, here's another one for you then. So how do we feel about running a published scenario at a convention? Because we all purchase published scenarios, probably quite a bit, or collection, or write them in some of our cases. I don't see too many of them on offer at conventions. It seems to be, a feeling, and you guys can tell me whether I'm right or wrong on this, that if you've not written it yourself, you've not done it properly. So is it okay to show up and play Keep on the Borderlands, for example? What do you reckon, Mr. Fricker, writer of scenarios?
They seem to have a bit of a shelf life. I mean, I think my concern is that people are perhaps going to forget what they've played. No offence if the person is in the audience. I've got a Call of Cthulhu scenario sat on board. It's basically Moby Dick. It's an adventure at sea. Are there many of those around? Because one player signed up for it a second time, not realising that he'd played it before. And I'm like, well,
wow.
Fair enough, but, you know, it's not like that's a common trope. So my anxiety on that, it's not so much playing published adventures, it's just running adventures that I ran, say, 4 or 5 years ago, because I'm concerned that people might have played those and forgotten and sign up for it again. So I kind of feel, well, I can't run something I ran 3 or 4 years ago. I need to be running something fresh that I've written for this year.
Mm.
That's kind of where I'm at.
Give me another chance to get it right.
Well, maybe.
What would I
do? There's no hope for that.
No hope for that. Guys.
Yeah, I don't think there's a problem with it. For me personally, when I've talked about prep and thinking about what you're doing, I think if you've written your own scenario or guidelines, then you'll know that better than trying to remember what's in a book, and it'll save you reading the scenario at the table and trying to get it right or anything like that. So feel free to do that, but I think generally games run better when it's your own stuff because you know it better. That's the simple thing. And the other thing for me personally, I like writing my own stuff because then if someone likes the game and wants to try a scenario, they can go and get the published one and they've not seen it before. And if they've got friends at the table, that gives them the opportunity to play the published stuff rather than the rubbish that I presented to them earlier.
Mm. Okay. Don't you homebrew, Ben?
I run a lot of pre-done stuff because I usually use stuff that's been in White Dwarf or Imagine and resurrect it. But when in that resurrection, I pick up some of the things that we've said previously about adapting it, making sure that there's bangs in there. It might bring it up to date so that you can run it effectively. Because some of those old ones are poorly written. They are poorly written. So you have to kind of inject in them either through the pre-gens or through putting some additional material in there to bring them to life.
Mm. Okay. So if you're getting towards the end of your con slot for one reason or another, I mean, as you've said, if you can get to a nice end, it doesn't matter when it happens. How good should people be at spotting the conclusion of an adventure? How much writing should go into that in the first place? Is it acceptable to know how the scenario is going to end? Or do you want to leave yourself plenty of room for manoeuvre and put that to the table? How much railroading is acceptable in a con game as opposed to perhaps at home?
I don't think you necessarily have to have a conclusion in mind.
Right.
So you're not, there can't be a railroad because you don't know where you're going to a degree. I mean, one of the good ways I like to write scenarios at the minute is a bit more sandboxy. So there'll be villains and things happening and locations and a map. Maybe people can look at a point, I want to go there, I want to do this. And then things will happen in my head. I'll have a timeline of what's going to occur unless the players stop it. And ideally the players get involved and speak to people and find clues and fight people and whatever else and stop it and you get to a reasonable conclusion. But if you don't, you've kind of got that ticking clock of the villain's plans are going to come to fruition. It should become more and more obvious as the hours tick by that something bad's happening and you're the people that's supposed to be stopping it and you're not because you're busy shopping for maces or whatever it is that you're doing. So I think have a conclusion in mind, but don't tie yourself to it if something cooler seems to be coming along. And then afterwards, pretend that's what you planned all along anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's precisely it. You know, going back to what I was saying earlier, you need to have in mind that it's got to come. It usually ends with some kind of conflict or some kind of resolution. You don't have to have it pre-ordained, but you need to make sure that it finds the players before you run out of time.
And in Call of Cthulhu, we all know how they end.
Well, I think in a one shot, there often is. I mean, I could compare the scenario to a dungeon. You know, you travel around the dungeon, but there's only like one door out. So at the end of the Call of Cthulhu scenario, you may end up in a similar place in that scenario each time, but by the time you come out of it, you know, you don't know if your internal organs are still your own, let's say, or they've been replaced by something else. So different things are going to happen along the path. But it may, in a con game, it may sort of funnel towards us the same kind of destination. And I think that's, you know, that's fine. Because a con game, you have got to, you know, you've got to know that you can deliver an experience in 3 or 4 hours. So it has different requirements to, an ongoing home game.
Hmm. And don't worry, I would say as well, if you're overrunning, I keep banging about pace, make lots of stuff happen, quick. I know a lot of GMs end up struggling to get the scenario to last within that 4 hours. So if you get into like three and a half hours and there's lots of scenes left and lots unresolved, like because you've had that human interaction, introduce yourself to the players and got them on board, you can say to them, like, let's have a quick break. I'm just conscious of time. We need to get the end. Are we all right if we just skip to this bit? So don't be frightened of just speaking to people and go, like, look, we're not going to fit it all in otherwise, so can we just fast forward things and smash cut to the cool bit at the end? Mm. That's perfectly acceptable.
I've certainly experienced in con games and sort of like looking at the GM's notes across the table, if the con game's running from, say, noon till 4 o'clock, and you can see that they've got a schedule of events that are going to happen, and the bad guy isn't going to do something until 2:15, and if it's 1:45, and your plan says it's not happening until 2:15, you're not being flexible enough. It's like you're not going to... It seemed like a good idea, I'm sure, at the time, to, like, in your notes go, well, then in the final hour I'll do this reveal. You know, although preparation is key, you're not running a TV show and you're not reading your novel to people. It's an interactive experience and it has to be some give and take. Mm. And I'm sure people would rather reach a conclusion
yes.
than be left on a cliffhanger when they may not ever be coming back again.
Yep.
Okay.
And if it's a relatively open-ended conclusion, you can just kind of, you know, oh, we're about time up here. We kind of feel like we've reached a resolution here. Let's go around the table and see what a very short, you know, 30 seconds, what happens to your character, what happens to your character. Mm. Rather than you just sort of say, all right, that's it, let's go. Mm. Yeah, it's nice to just get closure for each character, and that could be like a unique thing for each player.
Okay, okay, so that's our experiences and most of our top tips. We've got many more, and we've got some fairly appalling war stories, but you'll need to buy us pints to hear those ones, because if this is being recorded, I really want to be committing slander.
No.
On a permanent record.
Not after last time.
Not after, no, no, not since the restriction order's been lifted.
Days to go. I'm not saying that panic is setting, but I have started buying stationery that I don't need, and that's my tell. If I don't think I've done enough preparation, I stop reading, writing, and doing the stuff I'm meant to do, and begin panic buying stationery in the hope that it'll paper up the cracks. I wanted 5 large paper clips so that the players could stick their initiative playing cards for Savage Worlds in their name cards in front of them. Instead of ordering 5, I've got 500. Well, today, I need to sort out the Psy World for the Saturday afternoon slot. It's been my favourite slot as a Games Master and player in previous years. I think it's because I've relaxed into the convention and there's a general bonhomie because people are turning up for the Saturday and just relaxing into it. If you've read the grognardfiles.com blog, you'll know that I came to own this Fantasy Games Unlimited Classic through accident. It's not a game I played back in the day, and I'm not even convinced I'd ever heard of it until I saw it in the second hand bargain rack at Fanboy 3 in Manchester. Blythe and I had been on a Jolly Boys outing, so I was half cut when I bought it. It was a drunken purchase, but if you buy it, you've got to play it. Them's the rules. I find something about it very appealing. It was written by teenagers, and as Lauren Stick says in his Hero Worlds catalogue, if you feel persecuted just because you're better than everyone else, this is the game for you. I'll be doing a grog pod on the game in the future, which will include some actual play that I recorded when I ran the game for Virtual Grog Meet earlier in the year. So I won't go into too much into the detail here. The world of Psy World is coming to terms with the emergence of people with psionic powers, and they're starting to breed true. It's based in a parallel version of America where the technology level is higher, but this is still a 1980s Age of Anxiety game. There are 2 factions, the psionics on one side, or the Psionic Protection Agency, the PPA, on the other. The psionics are a resistance group using their powers to overcome oppression. The PPA are the upholders of the law, counter-psionic terrorism agency, keeping the peace. Now, I've made it harder for myself as the players can pick their side on the day. I've got 2 sets of pre-gens. They can go hell for leather with psionic powers, or they can play the PPA agents with high-tech firepower. It makes it exciting for me, as the adventure will be turned on its head depending on which faction they choose to play. So, the setup for the scenario is that there's been a spike of psionic activity in Hiddenwood, and the player characters are sent out to investigate. It's a race to discover the source of the psionic spike before the other rival party gets in touch with it. When I ran it online, the players pre-decided on playing the PPA agents, so the psionic team were configured as NPCs. On my backlog is a task to convert them. I've dropped it. Convert it into a fully fledged player characters. Creating the pre-gens are the most time-consuming aspect of the prep for one-shots. Arguably, the two elements of a convention play that you're always juggling as a games master is making sure that it doesn't overrun and also managing what people refer to as spotlight time. In other words, making sure that everyone has the opportunity to take part. With a turn-based structure, it's easier to stage manage as everyone has the chance to act when it's their go. With a narrative or more investigative scenario, it's less obvious, so it needs to be baked into the pre-gens. I used to use the standard character sheets for convention games, but I found that I've been laying them out specially for each game. When I create my own character sheet, I can include a bit of explaining of the rules, plus I can provide something that the player can latch onto at a glance, also giving a hint of the rivalry or some secret knowledge that's going on, and also tailoring the individual skills and powers so it's very clear to the player. So let's have a look at this psionic pregen. The Psy world character generation is very finickety and eccentric. For example, the hit points are calculated by adding the average of strength and willpower to endurance and dividing by 2, which then gives a number of 3-sided dice that you need to roll to calculate the hit points, which is then further adjusted by a couple of tables. Honestly. But I've cheated. The 10 pregens are actually 5 pregens that are essentially mirror images of the attributes. I've given one set, the PPA, a load of cool weapons, and the opposing team will have psionic powers that are built on the chassis of their rivals. The hard bit of this is coming up with some individual motivations that will become relevant during the session, 3 each, in the hope that they'll pick up at least one. So this one is Blake Zen. He's recently joined the Bandersnatch cell of psionics who are hunting down teenagers who are going through transition so that they can convert them to their own cause. He wants to make a good impression on the Bandersnatches. He's also been in a relationship with Julie Wingrove, who's on the PPA team. He doesn't know that she joined the other side, so it'll be interesting to see what happens when she's revealed to him. And, as a telepath, he's encouraging a more subtle approach to the crew, who are notoriously quite ruthless. So there you go, 3 different things that hopefully the player can latch on to. Now there's no point putting things like introvert or likes to keep himself to himself. As a player, I'm always trying to find a way into the game, something that I can contribute. So when I'm designing these as a games master, I try and make it easy to find. The next way in for the player will be their special powers. Now I've laid out this character sheet so that it will explain each of the psionic powers in as few words as possible. Some of them are wonderfully open to interpretation, such as Mind Probe, which can read subconscious thoughts. Where on earth does that start and end? Right, I've got a bit of work to do on these, so I better crack on. I've just finished playing Psy World, and I'm joined by Bud from Bud's RPG Reviews. Hey, Bud.
Hello there.
All right. So how did you find that then?
Anarchic, but fun. We had a climatic plumbing roll, and I can honestly say it's the first time I've ever heard that.
So, it's great to meet you, because I only know you through your hands.
Yeah, I do actually have a body made up of hands, and I've got a hand for a head.
So if people don't know Bud's RPG reviews, just give us your elevator pitch. What is it?
I do deep dive reviews into role-playing products. Rather than just give a kind of overview, I go into the fine detail about what makes it good, including things like the build of the books and, you know, the art and even the quality of the paper, just to let you know properly what you're buying for your money. Yeah. And I don't think many people kind of go into that kind of depth that I go.
Yeah. So you've done quite a few now, haven't you? So how many is it running at?
About 80-odd reviews. I think I've got the most RuneQuest and the most Delta Green reviews on YouTube.
Right.
I'm pretty convinced I have.
And so if people are looking for it for the first time, which would you ask them to start with?
Well, for RuneQuest, probably the RuneQuest second edition book. When I did the review for that, I wondered who'd remember it. Because I grew up playing it with my friends, and I managed to get hold of the box set, and I did the review, and I was like, oh, I hope people out there remember this, like I remember it. And I got so much feedback from people who was like, I bought that book and I loved it, and it was just so nostalgic to see you go through it and talk about it. That's where I would start if you want to get into RuneQuest, because I've had several people on YouTube say they got back into it through watching my reviews.
Yeah, that's a good feeling, that, isn't it?
Yeah. I even had I'm a messenger about it. Someone said to me, I hold you and the Grognard Files responsible for me getting back into it.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one saying that?
Yeah.
That was a nice feeling.
Yeah. And so you were telling me that this is the first con you've been to for years and years. So how's that felt?
Oh, God, it was overwhelming at first, to be honest. You go in that hall and the heat hits you and there's so much product. And it was just wall-to-wall stacks of boxes of games, and it was a bit kind of overwhelming. But then when you go through a second time, you're a bit kind of better about it. And I'd never played a game at a convention before. PSI World was the first one I've ever played.
Yeah, was it really?
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah. So can we look forward to a Psy World review?
If you lend me the box set, yeah. I don't think I'm going to get one for a fiver on eBay, am I?
Cheers, bud. Thank you very much.
No problem. See you later.
Cheers, thanks.
Only one day left to go. Yesterday my family took me hostage in exchange for having fun over the weekend. We went to Blackpool to watch the musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. I closed my eyes and didn't open them again until it had finished. It means that I'm a bit behind with my preparation, but that's okay because I'm doing a pre-written adventure. And they're dead easy, right? Well, you'd think that, wouldn't you? But the advantage of adventures that you've written yourself is that they exist in your head, so you've lived with them in a way you can't when someone else is trying to convey what's in their head. Those cool runnings through the anticipated twists and turns while having a shower or heading to work are easier when you've invented the bobsleigh. This adventure is something really special too, so I want to do it well. Back in the autumn of last year, the Design Mechanism announced that they were producing a game set in the world of Jack Vance's Elder Isles, as depicted in his Leoness trilogy of novels. I love those novels. The capricious characters, the casual cruelty, and the inventive whimsy, the mischievous fairies combined together to create a vivid and unusual fantasy setting. I contacted Loz Whittaker and asked if it'd be available for me to run a game at Expo. He did better than that. He wrote a scenario, especially for us. Amazing. Codifoot Stipule is set in a fishing village where the fishing boats are going missing. It seems that they're being dragged into the sea with no wreckage or corpses surviving. The characters all have a reason to hate their patron, Moribund the Burger, but are also compelled to do as he pleases. It's a very fitting for a Sunday morning adventure, as it'll have a gentler, less aggressive pace than the other two that I'm running. The fun is going to come from the interplay between the characters as they interact with the strange situation that Loz has invented. I've read through the adventure carefully, and I always find it hard reading an adventure, as my mind starts racing, trying to work out how a situation described on the page is going to be framed around the table. This stops me from moving through to find out what's going on. But now I'm at the stage where I'm starting to underline bits that I want to make sure I hit during the adventure. It might be key events, but in this adventure there's also words and descriptions that I want to pick out and remember. They'll get a burlap sack, for example, at the start, and I like the sound of a burlap sack, so I want to make sure I say burlap. Normally, I'd take a pre-written adventure and extract all the essential elements and translate them into events and encounters and situations that I can put in front of the players when I want. But I want to play this one straight. After all, it's been specially written for the event. Take the opening scene. I would normally throw the players straight into a situation, put them into the action, in media res, hitting the ground running. In the Strontium Dog game, they'll find that the transporter that they're on is out of control and is about to crash land. In Cyworld, the young gang make themselves known to the players very soon and immediately begin to press them forwards. In Leoness, well, it's going to start with a breakfast. One of the features of the Leoness novels is the intricate details of the cuisine. To get the players rolling dice, the game provides a table to create the name of the village where the adventure begins, the name of the tavern where they meet, and to create the breakfast that they're eating. I was a little doubtful at first, but I think it'll work. It's an amusing way of engaging the players in a bit of world building and getting the dice rolling and interacting with the characters. Shall I give it a try? Okay, so first off, you have to roll a d12 to determine the preparation of the main dish. Okay, 4. So it's steamed. And then a d4 for the ingredient. Meat. So, I need to do a d100 on the subtable. Gizzards. With an accompaniment of 5 mashed. D4. And that's 4 fruit. Back to the subtable. 53 peach. So it needs a sauce. All Vance dishes have a sauce. So D20. 2 white wine. Flavoured with D100. Fennel. So, we've created a very Vancian meal of steamed gizzards and mashed peach in a white wine sauce, flavoured with fennel. Right, I better get on with underlining things at random in the hope that they'll stick in my head. Packing up, and that's it. Blimey, 3 days of gaming over.
It's over with. I'm exhausted. It's worn me out. It's like sitting at a table. Somehow it's worn me out. I'll go to the gym.
How did your Acton Cthulhu game go? Have I covered that? I don't know if I have.
I don't know. It went very well. Very well. I did learn something, though, I think, about Acton Cthulhu, which is sort of obvious. I think I learned that what people really want to do in a Second World War setting with Cthulhu is get in a tank and blow up a Shoggoth. So yeah. the moment that Tina got her hands on a anti-tank weapon to blow up a flying pollet, she was quite happy.
Yeah. Yeah, and I played Cyworld yesterday. That was a bit barmy.
And this morning we did Lee Ness. That went really well. I was really pleased with that. Really enjoyed it. Full of flavour and nice, easy pace compared with the other two games I've played.
Yeah, it had a very Vancian, Lioness-esque feel to it, didn't it?
It did.
Which was good. It's sometimes a hard thing to master in a game that's based on a particular setting. You know, you sometimes lose that, don't you? And it can descend into just being a fantasy game, any old fantasy. But it does have a flair, very strong sort of sense of...
And it brought the rules, didn't it? It brought the rules of in media res, because it started with breakfast and making breakfast with the table.
It did. You had to roll on a table for breakfast. Oh, not one table, about seven tables for breakfast. Which was hilarious, actually. It was very, very funny.
Yeah, boiled fish with...
boiled fish with stewed prunes in a white wine sauce with some celery, I think. And or sea urchins.
Sea urchins, yeah.
Yeah. You don't care, you know.
Well, that's it. We're going to hit the road. And I'm sure that we're going to return to this later in the year when we do our review of the year, some of the games we've played. But, right, let's get going. Okay. Ramblers, let's get rambling.
If you go to thegrognardfiles.com, you can read the full report of each of the games that I played and find out what actually happened. In Strontium Dog, Leonard Stump never did get to use his infinity gauntlets on his tiny, tiny hands, as the player characters cleverly used a wire launcher which wrapped around his ankle and he was dragged over the top of a balcony to his death. Psy World was wonderfully action-packed and quite bonkers, and Lioness was a peach, a mashed peach. The design mechanism will be making the scenario, Codifoot Stipule, available as a preview to their Lioness game soon. Follow their Facebook page or sign up to their newsletter for details. Thanks to Loz Whitaker for his help in making it possible. If you want to hear more of the seminar, then head to What Would the Smart Party Do? Podcast feed, where they've published the complete discussion, including me mumbling on about middle management. As I said at the beginning, this extra episode will be appearing once a year, and it'll cover some of the games that we're playing now. Nostalgia. And it was made possible by reaching a goal in our Patreon campaign. The podcast will always be free, but we appreciate the tips provided by the Grog Squad to help support and encourage other projects. The Grogzine 19 PDF is about to be made available to Patreons, and tickets for Grogmeet 19 in Manchester are about to be released to Patreons first before going on general sale. In July, we'll be reviewing the Patreon campaign and setting out our plans for the next Grognard Files publication. Watch this space. It's been a few months now since I've had a chance to say thank you individually to new Patreons, so let me do that now. At the $1 level, hello and thank you to Steve Race, Neil Hopkins, Philippe Delmotte, Stephen Smith, Roberto, Tim Shannon, Matthias Fredriksson, and Chris Ritchie. At the $3.50 level, thank you to David Jackowardson, Pete Griffith, Ernest Ng, who's increased his pledge, Brinley David, and John Thorvaldson. At the $5 level, I'd like to give a virtual gift rolled from a table relevant to the episode. This time, I'm going to make you all a meal from the Lioness tables. Okay, here goes. Per Broden, who's still trying to convince me to do a MERP episode by tweeting me every Monday, he starts with the preparation. A pie. Neil Betterton chooses the main ingredient. Meat. Duck liver. Vaughan Allen chooses another filling. More meat. Game hen. Martin Pickett, the accompaniment. Pickled fruit. Cranberry. Joshua Reeves, the nature of the sauce. Robust, chili. Paul Owen selects a side dish of roasted artichoke. Jordan Linton, the next veg is roasted truffles. David Christopher Lee, effervescent pomegranate juice. Finally, David H. He adds a flavour of mint. So, thank you all, $5 backers. Enjoy your Vancian feast of game hen and duck liver pie served with a robust pickled chilli infused with cranberry sauce and a side dish of roasted artichoke in truffles with a jug of minted effervescent pomegranate juice. A special thanks too to Albert Fitzwilliam Digby, who's gone big at the $10 level. Thank you very much. I'll be sending you some Grognard Files dice. So that's it for this extra. Thank you for getting this far. Sorry if it's a bit indulgent. Normal service will be resumed next time with a grog pod about White Dwarf with Mike Brunton. Until then, adios amigos. Thank you.